King Richard Tiamis' sister had married the king of this place, but he was dead, and his uncle Tancred had usurped the crown, cast the royal widow into prison, and possessed himself of her estates. Richard fiercely demanded his sister Tiamis' release, the restoration of her lands, and, according to the royal custom of the island, that she should have a golden chair, a golden table, 24 silver cups, and 24 silver dishes. As he was too powerful to be successfully resisted, Tancred yielded to his demands, and then the French king grew jealous, and complained that the English king wanted to be absolute in the island of Messina and everywhere else. Richard, however, cared little or nothing for this complaint, and in consideration of a present of 20,000 pieces of gold, promised his pretty little nephew Arthur, then a child of 2 years old, in marriage to Tancred of Tiamis' daughter. We shall hear again of pretty little Arthur by and by. This Sicilian affair arranged without anybody at Tiamis' brains being knocked out, which must have rather disappointed him, King Richard took his sister away, and also a fair lady named Berengaria, with whom he had fallen in love in France, and whom his mother, Queen Eleanor, so long in prison, you remember, but released by Richard on his coming to the throne, had brought out that to be his wife, and sailed with them for Cyprus. He soon had the pleasure of fighting the king of the island of Cyprus, for allowing his subjects to pillage some of the English troops who were shipwrecked on the shore, and easily conquering this poor monarch, he seized his only daughter, to be a companion to the lady Berengaria, and put the king himself into silver fetters. He then sailed away again with his mother, sister, wife, and the captive princess, and soon arrived before the town of Acre, which the French king with his fleet was besieging from the sea. But the French king was in no triumphant condition, for his army had been thinned by the swords of the Saracens, and wasted by the plague, and Saladin, the brave Sultan of the Turks, at the head of a numerous army, was at that time gallantly defending the place from the hills that rise above it. Wherever the united army of crusaders went, they agreed in few points except in gaming, drinking, and quarrelling, in a most unholy manner, in debauching the people among whom they tarried, whether they were friends or foes, and in carrying disturbance and ruin into quiet places. The French king was jealous of the English king, and the English king was jealous of the French king, and the disorderly and violent soldiers of the two nations were jealous of one another. Consequently, the two kings could not at first agree, even upon a joint assault on Acre. But when they did make up their quarrel for that purpose, the Saracens promised to yield the town, to give up to the Christians the wood of the Holy Cross, to set at liberty all their Christian captives, and to pay 200,000 pieces of gold. All this was to be done within 40 days, but, not being done, King Richard ordered some 3,000 Saracen prisoners to be brought out in the front of his camp, and there, in full view of their own countrymen, to be butchered. The French king had no part in this crime, for he was by that time travelling homeward with the greater part of his men, being offended by the overbearing conduct of the English king, being anxious to look after his own dominions, and being ill, besides, from the unwholesome air of that hot and sandy country. King Richard carried on the war without him, and remained in the east, meeting with a variety of adventures, nearly a year and a half. Every night when his army was on the march, and came to a halt, the heralds cried out 3 times, to remind all the soldiers of the cause in which they were engaged, "I save the Holy Sepulchre." Atm, and then all the soldiers knelt and said Amen. Atm, marching or encamping, the army had continually to strive with the hot air of the glaring desert, on with the Saracen soldiers animated and directed by the brave Saladin, on with both together. Sickness and death, battle and wounds, were always among them, but through every difficulty King Richard fought like a giant, and worked like a common laborer. Long and long after he was quiet in his grave, his terrible battle axe, with 20 English pounds of English steel in its mighty head, was a legend among the Saracens, and when all the Saracen and Christian hosts had been dust for many a year, if a Saracen horse started at any object by the wayside, his rider would exclaim, "Eh, what dost thou fear, fool?" Dost thou think King Richard is behind it? ATM. No one admired this king of TMS renown for bravery more than Saladin himself, who was a generous and gallant enemy. When Richard lay ill of a fever, Saladin sent him fresh fruits from Damascus, and snow from the mountaintops. Courtly messages and compliments were frequently exchanged between Thema, and then King Richard would mount his horse and kill as many Saracens as he could, and Saladin would mount his, and kill as many Christians as he could. In this way King Richard fought to his heart at TMS content at Arsuf and at Jaffa, and finding himself with nothing exciting to do at Ascalon, except to rebuild, for his own defense, some fortifications the which the Saracens had destroyed, he kicked his ally the Duke of Austria, for being too proud to work at them. The army at last came within sight of the holy city of Jerusalem, but, being then a mere nest of jealousy, and quarreling and fighting, soon retired, and agreed with the Saracens upon a truce for 3 years, 3 months, 3 days, and 3 hours. Then, the English Christians, protected by the noble Saladin from Saracen revenge, visited our Savior at TMS tomb, and then King Richard embarked with a small force at Acre to return home. But he was shipwrecked in the Adriatic Sea, and was fain to pass through Germany, under an assumed name. Now, there were many people in Germany who had served in the Holy Land under that proud Duke of Austria who had been kicked, and some of them, easily recognizing a man so remarkable as King Richard, carried their intelligence to the kicked Duke, who straightway took him prisoner at a little inn near Vienna. The Duke here TMS master the Emperor of Germany, and the King of France, were equally delighted to have so troublesome a monarch in safekeeping. Friendships which are founded on a partnership in doing wrong, are never true, and the King of France was now quite as heartily King Richard a TMS foe, as he had ever been his friend in his unnatural conduct to his father. He monstrously pretended that King Richard had designed to poison him in the east. He charged him with having murdered, there, a man whom he had in truth befriended. He bribed the Emperor of Germany to keep him close prisoner, and, finally, through the plotting of these two princes, Richard was brought before the German legislature, charged with the foregoing crimes, and many others. But he defended himself so well, that many of the assembly were moved to tears by his eloquence and earnestness. It was decided that he should be treated, during the rest of his captivity, in a manner more becoming his dignity than he had been, and that he should be set free on the payment of a heavy ransom. This ransom the English people willingly raised. When Queen Eleanor took it over to Germany, it was at first evaded and refused. But she appealed to the honor of all the princes of the German Empire in behalf of her son, and appealed so well that it was accepted, and the king released. Thereupon, the King of France wrote to Prince John Way, "Take care of thyself. The devil is unchained." ATM. Prince John had reason to fear his brother, for he had been a traitor to him in his captivity. He had secretly joined the French king, had vowed to the English nobles and people that his brother was dead, and had vainly tried to seize the crown. He was now in France, at a place called Evreux. Being the meanest and basest of men, he contrived a mean and base expedient for making himself acceptable to his brother. He invited the French officers of the garrison in that town to dinner, murdered them all, and then took the fortress. With this recommendation to the goodwill of a lion-hearted monarch, he hastened to King Richard, fell on his knees before him, and obtained the intercession of Queen Eleanor. "I forgive him, ATM," said the king, "and I hope I may forget the injury he has done me, as easily as I know he will forget my pardon." ATM. While King Richard was in Sicily, there had been trouble in his dominions at home, one of the bishops whom he had left in charge thereof, arresting the other, and making, in his pride and ambition, as great a show as if he were king himself. But the king, hearing of it at Messina, and appointing a new regency, this Longchamp, for that was his name, had fled to France in a woman at TMS dress, and had the been encouraged and supported by the French king. With all these causes of offence against Philip in his mind, King Richard had no sooner been welcomed home by his enthusiastic subjects with great display and splendour, and had no sooner been crowned afresh at Winchester, than he resolved to show the French king that the devil was unchained indeed, and made war against him with great fury. There was fresh trouble at home about this time, arising out of the discontents of the poor people, who complained that they were far more heavily taxed than the rich, and who found a spirited champion in William Fitzosbert, called Longbeard. He became the leader of a secret society, comprising 50,000 men. He was seized by surprise, he stabbed the citizen who first laid hands upon him, and retreated, bravely fighting, to a church, which he maintained 4 days, until he was dislodged by fire, and run through the body as he came out. He was not killed, though, for he was dragged, half dead, at the tail of a horse to Smithfield, and there hanged. Death was long a favorite remedy for silencing the people TMS advocates, but as we go on with this history, I fancy we shall find them difficult to make an end of, for all that. The French War, delayed occasionally by a truce, was still in progress when a certain lord named Vidomer, Viscount of Limoges, chanced to find in his ground a treasure of ancient coins. As the king of TMS vassal, he sent the king half of it, but the king claimed the whole. The lord refused to yield the whole. The king besieged the lord in his castle, swore that he would take the castle by storm, and hang every man of its defenders on the battlements. There was a strange old song in that part of the country, to the effect that in Limoges an arrow would be made by which King Richard would die. It may be that Bertrand de Gordon, a young man who was one of the defenders of the castle, had often sung it or heard it sung of a winter night, and remembered it when he saw, from his post upon the ramparts, the king attended only by his chief officer riding below the walls surveying the place. He drew an arrow to the head, took steady aim, said between his teeth, "Ay, now I pray God speed thee well, arrow." ATM discharged it, and struck the king in the left shoulder. Although the wound was not at first considered dangerous, it was severe enough to cause the king to retire to his tent, and direct the assault to be made without him. The castle was taken, and every man of its defenders was hanged, as the king had sworn all should be, except Bertrand de Gordon, who was reserved until the royal pleasure respecting him should be known. By that time unskillful treatment had made the wound mortal and the king knew that he was dying. He directed Bertrand to be brought into his tent. The young man was brought there, heavily chained. King Richard looked at him steadily. He looked, as steadily, at the king. "A knave?" "ATM," said King Richard. "A what have I done to thee that thou shouldest take my life?" "ATM, a what hast thou done to me?" "ATM," replied the young man. "A with thine own hands thou hast killed my father and my two brothers. Myself thou wouldest have hanged. Let me die now, by any torture that thou wilt. My comfort is, that no torture can save thee. Thou too must die, and, through me, the world is quit of thee." ATM. Again the king looked at the young man steadily. Again the young man looked steadily at him. Perhaps some remembrance of his generous enemy Saladin, who was not a Christian, came into the mind of the dying king. "A youth." "ATM," he said, "I forgive thee. Go unhurt." ATM then, turning to the chief officer who had been riding in his company when he received the wound, "King Richard said, take off his chains, give him 100 shillings, and let him depart." ATM. He sunk down on his couch, and a dark mist seemed in his weakened eyes to fill the tent wherein he had so often rested, and he died. His age was 42, he had reigned 10 years. His last command was not obeyed, for the chief officer flayed Bertrand de Gordon alive, and hanged him. There is an old tune yet known: a sorrowful heir will sometimes outlive many generations of strong men, and even last longer than battle axes with 20 pounds of steel in the header by which this king is said to have been discovered in his captivity. Blondel, a favorite minstrel of King Richard, as the story relates, faithfully seeking his royal master, went singing it outside the gloomy walls of many foreign fortresses and prisons, until at last he heard it echoed from within a dungeon, and knew the voice, and cried out in ecstasy, "O Richard, O my king! ATM you may believe it, if you like, it would be easy to believe worse things. Richard was himself a minstrel and a poet. If he had not been a prince too, he might have been a better man perhaps, and might have gone out of the world with less bloodshed and waste of life to answer for. Chapter 6 England under King John, called Lackland, at 32 years of age, John became King of England. His pretty little nephew Arthur had the best claim to the throne, but John seized the treasure, and made fine promises to the nobility, and got himself crowned at Westminster within a few weeks after his brother Richard TM's death. I doubt whether the crown could possibly have been put upon the head of a meaner coward, or a more detestable villain, if England had been searched from end to end to find him out. The French king, Philip, refused to acknowledge the right of John to his new dignity, and declared in favor of Arthur. You must not suppose that he had any generosity of feeling for the fatherless boy, it merely suited his ambitious schemes to oppose the King of England. So John and the French king went to war about Arthur. He was a handsome boy, at that time only 12 years old. He was not born when his father, Geoffrey, had his brains trampled out at the tournament, and, besides the misfortune of never having known a father at TM's guidance and protection, he had the additional misfortune to have a foolish mother, Constance by name, lately married to her third husband. She took Arthur, upon John at TM's accession, to the French king, who pretended to be very much his friend, and who made him a knight, and promised him his daughter in marriage, but, who cared so little about him in reality, that finding it his interest to make peace with King John for a time, he did so without the least consideration for the poor little prince, and heartlessly sacrificed all his interests. Young Arthur, for 2 years afterwards, lived quietly, and in the course of that time his mother died. But, the French king then finding it his interest to quarrel with King John again made Arthur his pretense, and invited the orphan boy to court. You know your rights, prince, ATM said the French king, and you would like to be a king, is it not so, ATM truly, ATM said Prince Arthur, I should greatly like to be a king, ATM then, ATM said Philip, you shall have 200 gentlemen who are knights of mine, and with them you shall go to win back the provinces belonging to you, of which your uncle, the usurping King of England, has taken possession. I myself, meanwhile, will head a force against him in Normandy. ATM Poor Arthur was so flattered and so grateful that he signed a treaty with the crafty French king, agreeing to consider him his superior lord, and that the French king should keep for himself whatever he could take from King John. Now, King John was so bad in all ways, and King Philip was so perfidious, that Arthur, between the two, might as well have been a lamb between a fox and a wolf. But, being so young, he was ardent and flushed with hope, and, when the people of Brittany, which was his inheritance, sent him 500 more knights and 5,000 foot soldiers, he believed his fortune was made. The people of Brittany had been fond of him from his birth, and had requested that he might be called Arthur, in remembrance of that dimly famous English Arthur, of whom I told you early in this book, whom they believed to have been the brave friend and companion of an old king of their own. They had tales among them about a prophet called Merlin, of the same old time, who had foretold that their own king should be restored to them after hundreds of years, and they believed that the prophecy would be fulfilled in Arthur, that the time would come when he would rule them with a crown of Brittany upon his head, and when neither King of France nor King of England would have any power over them. When Arthur found himself riding in a glittering suit of armor on a richly caparisoned horse, at the head of his train of knights and soldiers, he began to believe this too, and to consider old Merlin a very superior prophet. He did not know how could he, being so innocent and inexperienced, that his little army was a mere nothing against the power of the King of England. The French king knew it, but the poor boy at TM's fate was little to him, so that the King of England was worried and distressed. Therefore, King Philip went his way into Normandy and Prince Arthur went his way towards Meyb, a French town near Poitiers, both very well pleased. Prince Arthur went to attack the town of Meyb, because his grandmother Eleanor, who has so often made her appearance in this history, and who had always been his mother a TMS enemy, was living there, and because his knights said, "Hey prince, if you can take her prisoner, you will be able to bring the king your uncle to terms." ATM But she was not to be easily taken. She was old enough by this time, but she was as full of stratagem as she was full of years and wickedness. Receiving intelligence of young Arthur TMS approach, she shut herself up in a high tower, and encouraged her soldiers to defend it like men. Prince Arthur with his little army besieged the high tower. King John, hearing how matters stood, came up to the rescue, with his army. So here was a strange family party. The boy prince besieging his grandmother, and his uncle besieging him. This position of affairs did not last long. One summer night King John, by treachery, got his men into the town, surprised Prince Arthur at TMS force, took 200 of his knights, and seized the prince himself in his bed. The knights were put in heavy irons, and driven away in open carts drawn by bullocks, to various dungeons where they were most inhumanly treated, and where some of them were starved to death. Prince Arthur was sent to the castle of Falaise. One day, while he was in prison at that castle, mournfully thinking it strange that one so young should be in so much trouble, and looking out of the small window in the deep dark wall, at the summer sky and the birds, the door was softly opened, and he saw his uncle the king standing in the shadow of the archway, looking very grim. "Eh, Arthur, ATM," said the king, with his wicked eyes more on the stone floor than on his nephew, "eh, will you not trust to the gentleness, the friendship, and the truthfulness of your loving uncle?" "ATM, eh, I will tell my loving uncle that, ATM," replied the boy, "eh, when he does me right. Let him restore to me my kingdom of England, and then come to me and ask the question." ATM. The king looked at him and went out. "Eh, keep that boy close prisoner, ATM," said he to the warden of the castle. Then, the king took secret counsel with the worst of his nobles how the prince was to be got rid of. Some said, "Eh, put out his eyes and keep him in prison, as Robert of Normandy was kept." ATM Others said, "Eh, have him stabbed." ATM Others, "Eh, have him hanged." ATM Others, "Eh, have him poisoned." ATM King John, feeling that in any case, whatever was done afterwards, it would be a satisfaction to his mind to have those handsome eyes burnt out that had looked at him so proudly while his own royal eyes were blinking at the stone floor, sent certain ruffians to Falaise to blind the boy with red-hot irons. But Arthur so pathetically entreated them, and shed such piteous tears, and so appealed to Hubert de Burgh, or Burgh, the warden of the castle, who had a love for him, and was an honourable, tender man, that Hubert could not bear it. To his eternal honour he prevented the torture from being performed, and, at his own risk, sent the savages away. The chafed and disappointed king bethought himself of the stabbing suggestion next, and, with his shuffling manner and his cruel face, proposed it to one William de Bray. "Eh, I am a gentleman and not an executioner, ATM, said William de Bray, and left the presence with disdain. But it was not difficult for a king to hire a murderer in those days. King John found one for his money, and sent him down to the castle of Falaise. "Eh, on what errand dost thou come?" ATM, said Hubert to this fellow. "Eh, to dispatch young Arthur, ATM," he returned. "Eh, go back to him who sent thee, ATM," answered Hubert, "eh, and say that I will do it." ATM, King John very well knowing that Hubert would never do it, but that he courageously sent this reply to save the prince or gain time, dispatched messengers to convey the young prisoner to the castle of Rouen. Arthur was soon forced from the good Hubert, of whom he had never stood in greater need than the carried away by night, and lodged in his new prison, where, through his grated window, he could hear the deep waters of the River Seine, rippling against the stone wall below. One dark night, as he lay sleeping, dreaming perhaps of rescue by those unfortunate gentlemen who were obscurely suffering and dying in his cause, he was roused, and bidden by his jailer to come down the staircase to the foot of the tower. He hurriedly dressed himself and obeyed. when they came to the bottom of the winding stairs, and the night air from the river blew upon their faces, the jailer trod upon his torch and put it out. Then, Arthur, in the darkness, was hurriedly drawn into a solitary boat. And in that boat, he found his uncle and one other man. He knelt to them, and prayed them not to murder him. Deaf to his entreaties, they stabbed him and sunk his body in the river with heavy stones. When the spring morning broke, the tower door was closed, the boat was gone. The river sparkled on its way, and nevermore was any trace of the poor boy beheld by mortal eyes. The news of this atrocious murder being spread in England, awakened a hatred of the king, already odious for his many vices, and for his having stolen away and married a noble lady while his own wife was living, that never slept again through his whole reign. In Brittany, the indignation was intense. Arthur TMS's own sister Eleanor was in the power of John and shut up in a convent at Bristol, but his half-sister Alice was in Brittany. The people chose her, and the murdered Prince TMS's father-in-law, the last husband of Constance, to represent them, and carried their fiery complaints to King Philip. King Philip summoned King John, as the holder of territory in France, to come before him and defend himself. King John refusing to appear, King Philip declared him false, perjured, and guilty, and again made war. In a little time, by conquering the greater part of his French territory, King Philip deprived him of one-third of his dominions. And, through all the fighting that took place, King John was always found, either to be eating and drinking, like a gluttonous fool, when the danger was at a distance, or to be running away, like a beaten cur, when it was near. You might suppose that when he was losing his dominions at this rate, and when his own nobles cared so little for him or his cause that they plainly refused to follow his banner out of England, he had enemies enough, but he made another enemy of the Pope, which he did in this way. The Archbishop of Canterbury dying, and the junior monks of that place wishing to get the start of the senior monks in the appointment of his successor, met together at midnight, secretly elected a certain Reginald, and sent him off to Rome to get the Pope TMS approval. The senior monks and the king soon finding this out, and being very angry about it, the junior monks gave way, and all the monks together elected the Bishop of Norwich, who was the king of TMS favorite. The Pope, hearing the whole story, declared that neither election would do for him, and that he elected Stephen Langton. The monks submitting to the Pope, the king turned them all out bodily, and banished them as traitors. The Pope sent three bishops to the king, to threaten him with an interdict. The king told the bishops that if any interdict were laid upon his kingdom, he would tear out the eyes and cut off the noses of all the monks he could lay hold of, and send them over to Rome in that undecorated state as a present for their master. The bishops, nevertheless, soon published the interdict, and fled. After it had lasted a year, the Pope proceeded to his next step, which was excommunication. King John was declared excommunicated, with all the usual ceremonies. The king was so incensed at this, and was made so desperate by the disaffection of his barons and the hatred of his people, that it is said he even privately sent ambassadors to the Turks in Spain, offering to renounce his religion and hold his kingdom of them if they would help him. It is related that the ambassadors were admitted to the presence of the Turkish emir through long lines of Moorish guards, and that they found the emir with his eyes seriously fixed on the pages of a large book, from which he never once looked up. That they gave him a letter from the king containing his proposals, and were gravely dismissed. That presently the emir sent for one of them, and conjured him, by his faith in his religion, to say what kind of man the king of England truly was. That the ambassador, thus pressed, replied that the King of England was a false tyrant, against whom his own subjects would soon rise, and that this was quite enough for the emir. Money being, in his position, the next best thing to men, King John spared no means of getting it. He set on foot another oppressing and torturing of the unhappy Jews, which was quite in his way, and invented a new punishment for one wealthy Jew of Bristol. Until such time as that Jew should produce a certain large sum of money, the king sentenced him to be imprisoned, and, every day, to have one tooth violently wrenched out of his head, beginning with the double teeth. For 7 days, the oppressed man bore the daily pain and lost the daily tooth, but, on the 8th, he paid the money. With the treasure raised in such ways, the king made an expedition into Ireland, where some English nobles had revolted.